passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleOmics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live from snowy Buffalo, New York, where today is January 2nd, 2022. And I'm joined today by my fellow cisgendered white male, Chris Gull.
It's great to be here, and we have quite the show for you today. On today's episode, we're going to discuss the comments from Big Swole and Tony Khan's response on Twitter and everything that came with that. We're also going to discuss the holiday tour live events for WWE, including the one in Buffalo that I attended. We're going to discuss some COVID protocol changes at the WWE Performance Center and much more on this first WrestleNomics of 2022.
Yes. That was so professional. That was excellent. Outstanding job, Chris Gull.
Well, okay. Thank you.
Are you ready to talk about race and gender? You ready to go?
Well, let's just get right into it.
Okay. First, let's start. I'll let you read this. Let's start with, this is from November 30th. Just to put us totally in context here. When Big Swole posted that she would be leaving AEW on November 30th.
Yeah, so this was from Big Swole on Twitter. Over the past couple months, my life has taken on the mantra, grow, learn, change. Dealing with shadow work took strength I didn't know I had. I thank God for my loving family because they got me through some of the roughest months of my life. But I realized the real test is application. So I took my leap, and after speaking with TK and AEW higher officials, we've decided not to renew my contract with All Elite Wrestling. This was a hard decision, but a needed one. I am grateful for their understanding that we can mutually come to this agreement. I've enjoyed my time with AEW and wish them all the best. I appreciate their love and welcoming me into the family. Today is my last day, and as bittersweet as it is, I am proud to say that I lived my dreams while making a difference. That is Swole mentality.
Okay. So then, on New Year's Eve, not that late in the evening yet, she did a, this is, I believe this is callinlive.com, which is apparently a website where you can, it's just an audio stream where you can have some sort of audio stream, and she was taking calls. Listeners of Post Wrestling will be familiar with Hanzi was I think her first caller. So people have probably heard, I'm guessing a lot of people who are listening are aware of the news that we're talking about today and have probably seen her comments referred to. The story that Tony Khan ends up quote tweeting, which is a Fightful story, transcribes a lot of her comments. Really all the comments, well, a lot of the comments that are pertinent to this. But we're going to play about a minute and 45 second clip of what she actually said, just so we can hear it directly from Big Swole.
There's nobody, there's no representation, truly. And when there is representation, it does not come across in the Black community as genuine at all. And I feel like there's, I don't know why everybody's just so either afraid to accept it or either afraid to say it, but it's just not a good look. What happens is you have this wonderful company that treats people like family, but there's nobody that looks like me that is represented at the top. They're not in the room with them. You know, they're not helping to, you know, not necessarily influence decisions, but also be there to explain, you know, why certain slang, why this certain word shouldn't be said, why this, that, and there. There's no one else who can explain our culture except for us, who can explain our experience except for us. And just the fact that, like, I knew something was up when my daughter, she loves watching wrestling. She would watch AEW all the time and seldomly watch WWE. She was not necessarily a fan of the product unless dad was on TV, which, of course, you know, stopped happening after they botched the Hurt Business. But she started saying, "Mommy, there's nobody that looks like me on AEW." And she's like, "Mommy, there's nobody that looks like daddy." And I was like, "Well," and then she started watching WWE because she saw Bianca, she saw, you know, Big E, like she was seeing people, she saw herself represented. And
okay, so I should mention too, she's referring to AEW throughout there. This was not the main topic of her audio stream. It wasn't the diversity part. She talked a lot about her time at AEW. This was a part of it, and a big part of the latter, I would say half or so, especially after she started taking some calls. So that happens. News sites, at least Fightful, transcribe your comments and posted a story about it. So Tony Khan had some comments, which you can read.
Yeah, Tony Khan actually quote tweeted the Fightful link, and he wrote, "The two top AEW executives are Brown, me and Mega, Jade Bowens, Caster, Dante, Nyla, Isaiah, and Mark Quinn all won on TV this month. The TBS title tournament has been very diverse. I let Swole's contract expire as I felt her wrestling wasn't good enough. Hashtag AEW Rampage, street fight tonight."
Yes. So Tony Khan did what any reasonable person would do when they're having an issue, especially like on a sensitive topic like race. Just go to Twitter and resolve this issue. By the way, if people are not familiar with Meg, if I'm saying her name right, Mega Parrick, I might be pronouncing your last name wrong as well. She's the executive vice president and chief legal officer for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Her LinkedIn profile says that she was working in a role for AEW until 2020 or so, but I gather that she's still very much involved with AEW from the context of that tweet. So you got Leo Rush tweeting things like "apologize" in all caps. But the next day, on yesterday, New Year's Day, almost 4 o'clock, he posts. He's clearly upset. You've got also other people in AEW making tweets to say that they've been, they're happy with how things are, people who are people of color and so forth. But then others not happy about it, including Leo Rush, who's in AEW. And then finally, yesterday afternoon, he went to the Notes app and posted this.
Yep. So he went to Notes app and said, "I want this to be clear. I do not consider this to be a diversity issue. And I at no point have thought or said that AEW or Tony is racist. We can clearly all see that wrestling as a whole and the AEW roster is purposely diverse. Now, the issue at hand was a racial insensitivity issue. Having spoken to Tony and Mega, we have discussed the endeavors to further understand the struggles of the Black community. I am grateful to be able to understand more about Tony and Mega's own ethnic backgrounds and glad that they are actively seeking input from an African-American perspective. I am proud to work for a boss and a company who tries to make these strides in social equality. I look forward to working with Tony to keep making steps toward positive change, and I pray that 2022 is a year of positive change in all aspects.
So we'll go over some data now. We'll look at WB and AEW. I'm going to look at their, at the top. We'll explain as we go. But I wanted to, it was easier for me to look at women's matches compared to men's matches, as opposed to when it comes to race, figuring out what race everyone was. In AEW's case, they have countless wrestlers who have had one-offs or have only had a couple matches for AEW, just because Dark is so prolific. I did try to figure out everybody's race, but at a certain point, it was like by visual sight, I just don't know. But what we can do is we can look at this. So what I have the cage match data scraped, and I went through, fortunately with our cage match data, we have match order as a column. So I took the match that was the latest match, theoretically the main event, in each TV program in 2021, the entire year. The great thing about doing a podcast on January 2nd is we can cleanly look at the recently finished calendar year. And I looked at the last match on each TV program in 2021 of AEW Dynamite, AEW Rampage, WWE Raw, WWE SmackDown, and NXT. So those five, the big five weekly wrestling programs. In the case of WWE, just because they're more often than the AEW programs, ending the program with something that's not a match, this may or may not be as pertinent to WWE, but the results seem intuitive. In the case of AEW, I think this is pretty reliable, because I remember when the go home show to, was it Full Gear, happened, and there's a contract signing between Kenny Omega and Adam Page. It really stood out that they ended this Dynamite without a match. So almost every Dynamite and Rampage are ending with a match, so it does reflect the main event. Why are we looking at the main event? Well, it gives you an idea of who's being put in prominent positions on the card. But here they are. Number one, the person with the most last matches on AEW are Jon Moxley, Darby Allin, Kenny Omega, Eddie Kingston, Sammy Guevara, Matt Jackson, Chris Jericho, Penta, Pac, MJF, Miro, Lance Archer, John Silver, Cody Rhodes. We're going to do the top 25. Rey Fénix, Orange Cassidy, Nick Jackson, Carl Anderson, Jungle Boy, Britt Baker, Doc Gallows, Dax Harwood, Daniel Garcia, and Andrade. So that's the 25. How many of those, Chris Gullo, of those people who we just named, are people of color?
I mean, there's a few. The Latin American community is represented, I think.
Yes.
Heavily here.
Yes.
But because we're talking about it, there is not a single African American on this list.
Yeah. I think Eddie Kingston, I think he mentions in the Tribune article that he has a Hispanic parent. Sammy Guevara, I believe, has at least one Hispanic parent. Penta and Rey Fénix are Mexican. Andrade is Mexican. As much time as I've spent with Daniel Garcia, I'm not sure. I don't know if that ever came up. Do you know?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe so. I know recently there was a picture taken with all the AEW wrestler of Hispanic heritage, and Garcia was in the photo. So
okay. So yeah, but no black wrestlers.
Andrade, well,
Andrade. So no black wrestlers. The rest of these folks, I would think, are white. But so when we go to WWE, number one with the most instances of having the last match on Raw, SmackDown, or NXT is Bobby Lashley, followed by Jey Uso, Big E, Drew McIntyre, Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, Jimmy Uso, Finn Balor, Tommaso Ciampa, Roman Reigns, Kofi Kingston, King Xavier Woods, Happy Corbin, AJ Styles, Rey Mysterio, Randy Orton, Pete Dunne, Dominic Mysterio, Charlotte Flair, Cesaro, Bryan Danielson, funny enough, Shinsuke Nakamura, Santos Escobar, Kyle O'Reilly, and Johnny Gargano. We've got two AEW wrestlers who have left WWE on that list. So, multiple black wrestlers on that list, right? Including Bobby Lashley, Big E, Kofi Kingston, Xavier Woods, and a few Hispanic wrestlers as well, right? Including, and Samoan wrestlers, the Usos, Roman Reigns. Yes. So, the issue that I think a lot of people had with Tony Khan's tweet is that he mentions Jade Cargill, Anthony Bowens, Max Caster, Dante Martin, Nyla Rose, Isaiah Cassidy, and Mark Quinn, who are a private party, the latter two. None of them appear in this top 25 list of people who have had the most main events on Dynamite and Rampage. So there's that.
All right. And moving on to, let's see here. We're breaking down the title holders in 2021.
So something else we can look at is, well, who's had the titles? This is very similar. Who have been the AEW World Champions? Adam Page and Kenny Omega. Who have been the TNT Champions in 2021? Cody Rhodes, Sammy Guevara, Miro, Darby Allin. Women's Champions have been Britt Baker and Hikaru Shida. AEW Tag Champions have been Lucha Brothers and the Young Bucks. So we've got, as far as people who are people of color there, we've got Sammy Guevara, Hikaru Shida, Lucha Brothers. WWE, an abridged list of their many titles. WWE Champions in 2021 have been Big E, Bobby Lashley, The Miz, Drew McIntyre. Universal Champion was only Roman Reigns. Raw Women's Champion, Becky Lynch, Charlotte Flair, Nikki A.S.H., Rhea Ripley, Asuka, SmackDown Women's Champion, Charlotte Flair, Becky Lynch, Bianca Belair, Sasha Banks. So we've got, as far as people of color here, Big E, Bobby Lashley, Roman Reigns, Asuka, Bianca Belair, Sasha Banks. So more in the case of WWE, looking at a limited number of their titles. Well, obviously, we could have gone even deeper, but let's look at the major titles, I figured, compared to AEW's fewer titles. And we can look at Google Trends too. This what's the use of looking at this? You could say it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. When we look at Google Trends, Google Trends to me are basically a measure of it's a measure of how much people are searching for, in this case, a given personality. I think it's also reflective of name ID. I think it's reflective of mind share. By that, I mean, how much are people thinking about this person? And the top 30 we've got here, CM Punk, Big Show, Bryan Danielson. This is in the entire year of 2021, actually January through November, because the December data will be complete probably tonight. CM Punk, Big Show, Bryan Danielson, Jon Moxley, Sting, Kenny Omega, Adam Cole, Chris Jericho, Mark Henry, Matt Hardy, Aleister Black, MJF, Cody Rhodes, Tony Khan, Andrade, Adam Page, The Young Bucks, Jake Roberts. Jake Roberts is always performing well in the Google Trends. Dustin Rhodes, Miro, this is worldwide, by the way. Tay Conti, Darby Allin, Christian Cage, Orange Cassidy, Jim Ross, Thunder Rosa, Britt Baker, Taz, Hikaru Shida, and Brandi Rhodes, the top 30. We've got people of color here. Mark Henry, not a wrestler for AEW, but just an announcer. He hasn't had any matches yet in AEW. Andrade, Tay Conti, who's Brazilian, Thunder Rosa, who's Hispanic, and Hikaru Shida, who's Japanese. Brandi Rhodes, of course. So there's that. And we can look at two. This is concerned with gender. I took all the events for WWE and AEW and I categorized them into event categories. So we're looking at the house show category, probably includes one show, the House Always Wins show. This is, again, for the entire calendar year of 2021. But we've got pay-per-view pre-shows. We've got what I categorized as streaming events, which is Dark Elevation, the women's Eliminator tournament that they did that was on YouTube, and the one instance of the Rampage buy-in on the Friday Night War night. Basically, these are things that were on YouTube for them that I'm calling streaming. In the case of WWE, this will include 205, basically everything that's only on Peacock, 205 Live, WWE main event, NXT UK, and the Superstar Spectacle. There might be a couple miscellaneous events in there as well. And then we've got the television category, which in AEW's case is Dynamite and Rampage, and in WWE's case is Raw, SmackDown, and NXT. And then we've got pay-per-view, or as they have been retroactively renamed, live premium events. So I apologize to WWE for using this banned term. So what stands out here? Women overwhelmingly dominate the pay-per-view pre-show for AEW. Now, AEW does 4 pay-per-views in a year, so this was reflecting probably 4 pay-per-view pre-shows. 67% of the matches on the pay-per-view pre-shows have been women's matches. If you compare that to WWE, it's only 38%. Streaming, 31% of the streaming matches were women's matches, and then it diminishes from there, which I think this is in order of importance, right? The streaming matches, at least these last 3, television is next important, and pay-per-view is most important. 22% of the television matches have been women's matches. 14% of the pay-per-view matches have been women's matches for AEW. In the case of WWE, it's more favorable, somewhat, to women, where you've got their streaming shows. Only 20% of the matches are women's matches. This might be driven by 205 Live until recently being all men's matches. But anyway, the house show, the TV, and the pay-per-view for WWE are very similar. 28% of house show matches are women's matches, 29% of television matches, and 29% of pay-per-view matches. Again, what is that? How does that compare to AEW? You know, 22% of TV, 14% of pay-per-view, versus we've got basically a breakdown of 71-29 for WWE. So there's that. WWE has more women's matches by percentage. WWE is this massive brand, that massive company that has all these different brands of wrestling. So they've got way, way, way more matches on the whole. But as a percentage, at least on TV and pay-per-view, they have more women's matches. And in the case of AEW, they have on TV and pay-per-view a smaller percentage of women's matches. But if you're on streaming, where, you know, if you're on Dark and Dark Elevation, where things are somewhat less important, this is somewhat stacked by the Women's Eliminator tournament. I would guess not that much, though, because of how the vast number of matches that have happened on Dark and Dark Elevation. So anyway, now another thing I looked at here is the number of minutes, the average length of men's and women's matches. You would think that the women's matches would be shorter. That is the reputation, is that women's matches are like 2 minutes and then they get them out of there. So what we see is, and the main thing I think we want to look at first is what's happening on television and on pay-per-view. The average match on television for men in AEW is about 8.5 minutes, and it's just under 7 minutes for women. So shorter for women. Similar case, though, similar difference on television for WWE. Matches on WWE are actually longer on average. Almost 12 minutes for men on television in WWE, just over 10 minutes on television for women in WWE.
Which is very interesting, because that's not the narrative on Twitter.
I know WWE did the Queen of the Ring tournament that had a exceptionally short, right? Like every match was 2 or 3 minutes long. But yeah, I think a lot of this, just the fact that that the matches are all longer, the averages, right? I mean, at least for television, both the men's and the women's matches are longer on average, I think is probably driven by, firstly, you've got Raw is 3 hours long and they've got to fill it out with something. But even pay-per-view is longer. 14.4 minutes is the average pay-per-view men's match. 13.8 minutes is the average women's match. And for women, the average pay-per-view match is actually longer. 12.5 minutes for women, 12 minutes for men. I wonder if that's driven by like battle royals or something. I know they just did the women's battle royal. So,
all right.
And then
viewership, right?
And then we can look at viewership. This is something that I've shared before. So this is not terribly up to date. This is from the period of July 1st to September 12th. So roughly almost the entirety of Q3, where we see that who has the largest white audience by percentage? It's AEW. Who has the largest people of color audience? WWE. And WWE has an especially large black audience, with SmackDown in that period averaging 26% of its audience. Black Americans is U.S. viewership. NXT 21% black. WWE Raw 23% black. And the Hispanic audience by percentage for WWE is larger too. Even comparing against Impact, with Impact having a pretty small sample, I always sort of, at least in week to week changes, I'll say, you know, I wouldn't take the week to week changes of Impact that seriously. But if we're looking at a large period of time average, where we've got many data points to average together, this is probably more reliable. 56% of the Impact audience in this period was white, 18% black, 19% Hispanic, and 7% another race. How does this compare to the universe estimate that is the entire U.S. population? The U.S. population, according to this, and maybe this is the television, I think this is the whole population, though. 61% white, 13% black, 19% Hispanic, and 7% an other race. So this tells me that WWE over-indexes in black viewers. AEW is right about on par with the population. But what I read from this, though, is that maybe the potential audience of wrestling fans, maybe more so reflected in WWE's breakdown, is that the average, the wrestling population, or the potential wrestling audience, is relative to the population disproportionately black. And if that's the case, AEW is not capturing that potential audience, or it's capturing an audience that is more reflective of the U.S. population. So we got another thing to look at here. This is just the people will often ask me, well, has it changed recently, you know, since they started to push, whether it's, you know, Bianca Belair or Big E? I don't have it going back further than this. And I know there's an old Sports Business Journal article that references some Scarborough survey data, where the percentage of black viewers is over 20% there too. So I don't think that this is something that has grown or changed recently. I think this has been the W audience for a pretty long time. So there's that. Yes.
I do want to say, so, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit later. I attended the live event in Buffalo. Six of the seven matches had a wrestler of color in the show. Mm-hmm. And two of the seven matches featured females. So,
yeah. So I've theorized why is there this difference in audience, and maybe it's even applicable to why there is this difference in roster. And that when I've been on indie shows, especially like the super indie shows, I've been at, you know, I did Uncharted Territory and so forth. I used to, you know, after the match, after I was done wrestling, I used to stand in the merch table, and you sort of look out at the crowd, and sometimes I would notice and think about it, be like, oh, wow, this is disproportionately white men here. And why is that? Maybe there are economic factors involved in that, you know, independent wrestling, both for fans and for wrestlers, I suppose, there's a lot of travel involved. And in the case of wrestlers, there's training involved, and, these things cost money. And as we know, there's been a great deal of economic inequality throughout this country's history based on race. So maybe that's part of it. But clearly WWE, I mean, we just went over who's being featured prominently, on these cards. And this is one analysis. There's other things we could probably do to address this question, but I mean, it's right from the top, Bobby Lashley, and at number three, Big E. And I mean, the Usos are Samoan. So there's clearly people who are people of color who are featured in prominent roles, a lot more so than the case of WWE. So Any other thoughts before we talk about Tony Khan's tweets?
No, I mean, we break down the data. We show, you know, there could be tweets and responses all day long. We're trying to break down the data as best we can to kind of paint the picture of what's actually going on. And you can kind of see it there. And like I said, from my experiences at the live show, you know, WWE has a very, very diverse roster. And I probably don't get enough credit for it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this is on New Year's Eve, and not that New Year's Eve was a determining factor, but you know, this caused a lot of subsequent reactions on Twitter and a lot of controversy. So I don't know. I think tweeting about this in the way that he did is not a great idea. If we're talking about from a purely economic and PR standpoint, it makes the situation worse to address it the way that he did. That's the perception that I have. Now it's Twitter. Maybe it's probably only a relatively small portion of your audience that's going to be aware of this. But it puts it more in people's minds. We're probably not talking about Big Swole's comments this morning if he doesn't tweet what he tweeted. This is not the first time that Tony Khan is tweeted in reaction to criticism. Just a couple weeks ago, when he tweeted this, and I told you, oh, we're going to have to talk about this. I said, oh, Tony Khan is 2 for 3, 2 out of 3 weeks where he's made us talk about something that we probably wouldn't talk about otherwise. It was a couple weeks ago where he was responding to the Fox News article about you know, AEW's ratings, what's going on with AEW's ratings, and Shad Khan had a tough week with Urban Meyer having to be fired and things like that. So I think this, what are the issues with the tweet, is that he's mentioning wrestlers who are not featured that prominently, who are mid-carders, and her wrestling wasn't good enough. A lot of people took issue with, too. I would imagine that Tony's feeling is that, you know, if somebody's going to criticize you in a way that he feels is not valid, not legitimate, that it's beneficial to react to it and get that hashtag going. He made sure to hashtag that AEW Rampage. So there have been times, actually, where Tony Khan has not tweeted that much, and according to Social Blade, and AEW did just fine. I mean, throughout... throughout the spring and into the summer, well, I guess the entirety of the summer, he averaged 0 tweets per day. You know, he could have tweeted something to the effect of, you know, we're very proud of our diverse roster and we're 100% committed to, you know, keeping that going forward, or something put more eloquently than that. You know, and another thing you could say is that, look, AEW's got a pretty strong Hispanic representation, whether that's the Lucha Brothers, Andrade, Sammy Guevara, Ricky Starks. There is a lack, especially of black wrestlers featured in prominent positions. To the really engaged fan with this type of information, I think it does lead one to wonder, regardless of what the finish is, so that the TBS title final will be Jade Cargill and Ruby Soho. And if she wins, well, did they change the finish to, because of this? Are they overcompensating? If she doesn't win, some people will probably be upset, but yeah. One thing that Swole mentioned in the audio stream, and I listened to a lot of it. I didn't listen to all of it, but a lot of it is, she mentions that, you know, that people are saying, well, yeah, just wait 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then you can have a black main eventer or something like that, a black champion in an AEW. Now the wrestlers have got to be over, but part of being over is a self-fulfilling prophecy of who you give, opportunities to get over. Is there somebody on the AEW roster right now, especially on the men's side, if you're going to feature, taking it for granted that you're going to feature the men more prominently, is there somebody on the men's side who you would push to be a main eventer? I don't know, maybe. But it brings to mind something that I remember James Baldwin saying in the 1960s, not that I was alive then, about Bobby Kennedy in like 1965 was saying that, you know, I think in 30 years or so, we could have a black man be the president. And James Baldwin say that, you know, to the point of view of the barber in Harlem, Bobby Kennedy showed up 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, maybe to white people, this sounded like a very refined and very optimistic thing to say, that there could be a black president in 30 years, you know, if you're good, you know, if everything goes right, if you behave, maybe you could be president. In a country where black people have been discriminated against for our lifetime and beyond, and obviously there's a history of black people being stolen and their labor being stolen, their children being stolen, to build the country so that people can have an American dream, so that you know, people like Shad Khan can come over and immigrate to the United States and live the American dream, become a billionaire. So, anything to add, Chris Gall?
No, but we do have quite a few super chats this morning.
Oh, wow.
Which, first off, thank you all. We're also seeing a lot of just great comments about thanking us for what we do. We really appreciate you guys for joining us this early on a Sunday morning here. But yeah, we had a few super chats, and if you want to use the super chat feature, it starts at $1, whatever you feel like donating to ask a question. We'll start with the most recent one, but we can backtrack because the most recent one ties into what we just talked about. Easy Attack, he asked, is there any way to number crunch the numbers of the ages of black people who watch WWE programming and AEW programming? That's from Christopher Early.
I believe that's Dr. Eli. Is there any way to number crunch the number of the ages? There might be if I had a Nielsen subscription, which I do not. Basically, what happens with the television viewership data that I have and that you see, I'll put it back on the screen here. Information like this, or really any TV viewership data, is either through Showbiz Daily or some other source that is generous enough to share with me Nielsen data. I would imagine if I had a Nielsen subscription, which costs, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, and really only enterprises get Nielsen subscriptions, I might be able to generate some kind of report that would give me answers to that. It's something I could ask for and look into. But yeah, I know we want like a breakdown across race and age and gender. And that would be very helpful. It's how much do I want to bug sources to give me information. So I'll see what I can do. But thank you very much for the easy chat, for the super chat. And everybody should listen to the NWA podcast, which you may be familiar with, on the Post Wrestling podcast feed, where I imagine they'll be having some thoughts about this story on their next episode.
We had a question from our team machine. This might be a stupid question, but does TV get money for ratings? So yeah, what happens here is that if a program, you know, performs in a positive manner, whether demographics were of the advertisers looking for, advertisers are going to put more money towards, you know, advertising on television programs, depending on the performance. And that's what comes down to TV rights deals and all that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a relatively new phenomenon that wrestling programs are getting guaranteed money. It used to be not that long. Let's say the Attitude Era, I think, where they were just getting their advertising money. WWE was selling their advertising money themselves, or selling their advertisements themselves. In the case of WWE, WWE is popular enough, valuable enough that their money is all guaranteed, at least in the U.S., their money is all guaranteed from NBC Universal and from Fox. NBC Universal and Fox sell the ads that you see during Raw and SmackDown. They keep that. The networks keep that money. They don't share it with the WWE. WWE is getting $4 to $5 million per episode. I believe $4 million per episode on an average annual basis for SmackDown, $5 million per episode on an average annual basis for Raw. And that's what they get. Doesn't matter what their viewership performance is. Ratings go up, ratings go down. WWE makes the same amount of money for the duration of their contract. Now, it's important to keep ratings strong because to keep your partner happy, and so that you're an attractive piece of content for people to for networks to want to pay a lot of money for in your next round of negotiations. So it's important to WWE and AEW or anybody to do strong ratings because of that. In the case of AEW, their contract is not all guaranteed. I believe most of their compensation is guaranteed money, but there is some of it that is variable depending on how well their ad sales go. And it has been explained to me that television advertisements are, advertisers are guaranteed a certain performance, a certain viewership, probably in a given demo. And if the advertiser, if the network, you know, meets that guarantee, great, everything's wonderful. If they don't, then they have to do make goods, which I think it's something near this, and maybe exactly this, but maybe at least near this, that if they don't meet that guarantee, then they have to do make goods, which is basically the network using its unsold inventory, that is unsold ad units, ad slots, get inserted on some other program where the inventory is not sold, and they make it up to that number of impressions or something like that. Yeah.
And that's how it was a lot. But in the night, when I read the Nitro book, that's how a lot of it was for WWE programming throughout the 90s. It was just like, hey, and we'll also throw in wrestling, and they're like, okay, whatever. But it was basically free for the major advertisers.
Yeah. There's wrestling has a reputation of being the depository for make good advertisements, I think.
And then just Diggy Bird just has a comment for us. He goes, Happy New Year's, guys. Have always been a fan of your work. Love you are doing this important episode. Well, thank you, Dickie.
Thank you. Yes, I believe Diggy Bird made the post wrestling intro, which is amazing that they've been using on their daily news update.
All right. So we will move on here to the WWE.
So this was an indie show. This is a picture from an indie show, I think, that you were at, right? What is this?
No.
Were you the ring announcer for this? What is this?
From the WWE holiday tour.
Did you take Thursday. This picture?
I don't know if I took it that long. I did send Russell Tix quite a few pictures. He was asking about certain sections, and yes, I tried to get pictures of him and all.
I was in the DMs. I was in the DMs with Russell Tix, and I was like, I told Gallo to send you some pictures. He's like, oh yeah, he's been really helpful.
Yeah, so I don't remember if I actually, because I don't think, I think I took a lot of mine from the like walkway when you're going down where the ushers are to kind of get a full perspective. I don't think I got that low. I know there's probably some other people sending photos as well.
I always want to ask, when I see pictures like this and I see the ring is empty, I imagine bell time is like 7. Is this like 6 o'clock when nobody's there yet, or is this how it looked throughout the show?
I would say it was just a little bit more than that. So with the photos that the photos that I sent to Russell Tix, I took as soon as Byron Saxton said the show has begun. And those were my original photos, and the other photos were just while a match was going on. You know, I believe Mansoor and his name escapes me, from Ridge Holland, were wrestling each other. So I was pretty fair in that. You know, I was going to be fair, and you know, when he asked me for photos, I waited till the show actually started, you know, and waited till pretty much everybody was back from intermission to take the other photos.
Okay,
which we'll talk about in a second.
So is this what it looked like? This is what it looked like.
I would say it looked
representation.
It was more full than that.
Okay. So this is part of the anti-WWE propaganda then.
That was probably taken, I'd say, at 7:15 even.
What time did the show start?
7:30.
Okay. Wrestle Tix has the final count. We're focusing on Buffalo because we live in Buffalo, but Wrestle Tix had the final count at 3,731 for Buffalo, the 30th, Thursday. So Wrestle Tix has this chart of North American house shows that I've turned 90 degrees into a bar chart. This was one of the lower performing house shows that WWE has done. Grand Rapids was comparable. Corpus Christi was lower. Charleston, West Virginia was lower. And Syracuse, New York was lower. This is within the last month and a few weeks. So well below average for WWE, but you know, if we look at the average for events for WWE and AEW, always noting that yes, WWE is running way more events. This includes house shows and TV tapings. It's notable though that this last week of December is usually a really strong period for them. We'll talk about Madison Square Garden in a moment. We've got an average in December of 6,153 for AEW, 6,200 to WWE's 5,600. So for the second month in a row, on an average basis, we've got 5 AEW shows to 20 WWE shows. In the month prior, November, 7 AEW shows to 21 WWE shows. But for the second month in a row, and I guess this is 3 out of the last 4 months because of September, AEW has a stronger average attendance. It would be more fair to look at this by TV tapings for WWE, looking at Raw and SmackDown versus whatever TV tapings AEW is doing. That would be more fair. Unfortunately, we don't have that prepared. But it's even that besides, I think this is meaningful towards the story of WWE's not doing as well. I mean, that AEW is doing at least comparably to WWE, which, I don't know, AEW is not a company that existed 3 years ago, or maybe it just launched, in fact, 3 years ago, had ran no events, and something is happening here in the wrestling industry. So
just my thoughts, because that WWE live event that I attended Thursday night was probably the first WWE live event I've attended in quite a few years, especially a house show. It's been a few years since I've seen a house show there. My ticket was free, as a friend of mine won tickets on the radio and said, hey, he knew I was the wrestling guy. He's like, hey, you want to go? It's like, sure, why not?
Said, so you're a comp.
I knew multiple people that won tickets off the radio. It seemed just by the comments behind me, the two middle-aged men that were making various interesting comments throughout the night probably won their tickets on the radio. I don't think they paid for, like, who's this guy? Who is this person? Who's that person? So I think there was probably a lot of comps. Mm-hmm. I have two critiques, wrestling experience, the matches were great. The talent did well. But the two critiques I have is that Byron Saxton started the show with, hey, as COVID has affected the world, we unfortunately had to make changes to tonight's event, but the talent that are here, they're here to put on a great show for you. Never started with, hey, ladies and gentlemen, Roman Reigns is not here this evening if you would want a refund. This is something that they used to do. I remember them doing this specifically once where John Cena was supposed to be at a WWE show in Buffalo, and they offered a refund. You can get a refund up to intermission, and then, of course, you had to leave and got your refund. They did not offer that.
They didn't. So Roman Reigns was advertised for this?
Yes.
And they did not tell you that Roman Reigns wasn't going to be there. They just told you that some people aren't going to be here.
Yeah. If you go on the internet, you knew, because you knew he wasn't in Baltimore the night before, and you saw the reports that he was pretty much taken off the holiday tour.
No one reads the internet. It's a vocal minority.
I feel as a ring announcer myself, and we've battled this throughout the last few years, like, when do you announce a cancellation to the audience? And I think just lead off with it. You have to let them know, because if you got the fans stringing along, oh, maybe they're here. Think of the kid that doesn't read the internet, and he's like, oh, I can't wait to see Reigns, and Reigns never shows up.
I think that telling, being as upfront as early as possible, being as transparent as possible with people is worth, even though that may cause you more quick pain, more immediate pain. I think you're earning the trust of your customers. which is not something that wrestling companies historically seem to value as much as I think they should. I've had many arguments about this subject. with someone.
And that's why I said we, when I, like, because me and you have had this conversation with people.
Yes. Yes.
One other thing I want to say from the live event, too, and this might not be a WWE issue, but it was something to me who has participated in a lot of live events across wrestling, comedy. You know, I've actually helped put on music shows as well. So they went to intermission at 9 o'clock. As I walked out into the hallways of the KeyBank Center, Buffalo, New York, 95% of the stands that were open before the show started were closed. Mm-hmm. Concessions.
Concessions.
And I said something to, I asked one of the workers who was like cleaning up, and I said, what's going on here? Like, she's like, well, we were told there was no intermission from our bosses. So I don't know if that was an arena issue or a WWE issue, but that's a major, major like folly on somebody's. I mean, that's missed financial opportunity there. Mm-hmm. And it's only an hour and a half in the show to close all the concessions. When you go to a Sabres game, they start doing the third period, you know, which is about 2 hours into the game.
So they did an intermission with no concessions.
There was two stands open.
And the whole arena? Stand.
Yeah.
It's three levels.
Yeah, but the 300 level was closed off.
Oh, the you're right, of course.
200 level doesn't really have concessions. So really the majority of concessions are 100 levels. And we walked around the arena because, full disclosure, I was trying to find a beer. Walked around the arena because the two food stands were open, did not have beer.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we can hook up W with Riverworks or something. The smaller venue a few blocks away that we've run indie shows at, or been a part of indie shows at.
All right,
I do wonder if, and if people have raised this issue to me, like, why are they running these big venues? I can understand the holiday tour because you expect attendance to be a lot better than it was, but why are we running, you know, what would be a pay-per-view sellout? What would be a really full sellout at this venue? It would probably be like 11 or something like that, 11,000. And you've put under 4,000 in there. A lot of it not paid. I mean, that's like a third full. Why are we running the most expensive venue in the city, in the metro area to do this? Is there a benefit in fortifying and reinforcing a relationship with this venue when you do run Raw here and it sells better, maybe. And you look at that live events division, and it's lost money in many quarters pre-pandemic. And I expect I would be this is just barely included in Q4. I expect this Q4 live events division to report a loss in operating income, which I am scrambling to open the trending schedules to show you that that's really the case. If we look at, if I can make this, just we'll quickly look at this. This is on W's corporate website. It's something that W reports themselves. If we look at, so obviously W is super profitable. W is going to report $1 billion of revenue, and it's going to report its all-time highest, most profitable year ever in February when it reports on the full year of 2021. But they do tell us, we can look at this in a way so that you can see it. But they do tell us by division how profitable each division was. And if we look at, we've got 2019 on this time span here, and where we can see that in so the entire, 2019, there's no pandemic, and there's only one positive operating income quarter for WWE, and that was the WrestleMania quarter where they reported $12.4 million in operating income in the live events division. As you can see, the media division is much more profitable, but they basically broke even, negative $200,000 in Q1, lost $3.5 million in Q3, lost $1 million in Q4. Does it make sense to run all these house shows if your attendance is going to be that weak? Q3 was great. Average attendance was amazing in Q3. Why are you running house shows, though? There's some values in it. you're marketing, you're going to a town and establishing memories for fans who may spend and engage with WWE more later because they were there. That's a value. Hard to assess what that value is. You're giving performers experience. That has a value. Again, hard to assess what that value is, but that has a real value. I think that's a value that is really needed for their developmental, especially when you're signing more non-wrestlers than ever before. Yeah, this is questionable. Why are you doing this? House shows for the entire history, well, my entire memory have always been these weird settings where nothing really matters. You could kind of, if you're a halfway paying attention wrestling fan, you know that nothing matters. Nothing of consequence is going to happen here. It's isolated. The things of consequence happen on television. So no wonder the attendance isn't that good for these events. I don't know. Anyway.
Just a few comments real quick about what you said there. As far as no consequences, I mean, here's the thing, too. If you're a fan that goes on the internet, this was the same exact lineup and card and results that happened in Baltimore the night before.
Right.
So there is no change.
You're still doing that. And yeah, go ahead. Keep going.
Oh, I was just saying, and as far as the house show perspective, we see financially, other than, you know, Q3, it's not a gain for WWE. And for the talent themselves to lighten that workload schedule would be probably huge. One thing I had to say, you bring up experience, though, especially for these wrestlers, they'll be coming up through the Next in Line program and whatnot. There's been that narrative out there, I think, like, you know, I know Chris Elner from Between the Sheets always brings it up about Nick Khan actually having, like, a WWE, like, live event experience in Las Vegas with, like, shows. And that might be where you get these guys' experience, where they, you know, three shows a day in Las Vegas, you know, from September to May, and that's where they're going to get their experience in front of fresh tourist crowds.
Yes. I should have probably mentioned this at the top. Speaking of Between the Sheets, Chris Elner, I'm going to, not on this live stream that people are watching on YouTube, but later in the program, I'll be talking to David Bixenspan about some research he's been doing related to pay-per-view buys. So I'll be recording that later today, and that'll be in the latter portion of this podcast.
One other question from Super Chat from RT Machine. Does picture-in-picture commercials give the same amount of money than normal commercials?
Thank you for the Super Chat. If you look at, if you go back and watch one of the live streams that I did with Chris Harrington, who's the founder of this podcast and the senior vice president of business strategy for AEW, I asked him that question. I think it was on one of our remote streams. And he paused and he said something to the effect of, the fact that we do picture in picture means that it works. I think I was actually asking him, do advertisers find that as valuable? Do they feel like it's distracting from their message? So what was the original question again?
Is it the same amount of money as a normal commercial?
I don't know. I mean, I imagine it's whatever it is, they've calculated that it's worth it. What it probably does, what I would theorize it does, is that it drives retention better. What we see in the minute-by-minute viewership is you can, you know, what's a draw? What's not a draw? You know, it's not any wrestler more than anything. It's the commercials. When a commercial's on TV, that audience dips by like 20%. Commercial's over, yeah, they come back and mostly. So I imagine picture-in-picture lessens that tune-out that comes with a commercial break. So there's some value to gain there in the C1, C2, C3. What is that? When we talk about live plus same day, that's the viewership that happens live and within the same day. And sometimes you hear people talk about live plus three. That's all the live viewership plus the 3 days afterward viewership on DVR and delayed viewing. Then live plus seven, which is just the same thing, but plus 7 days. But what really matters as far as meeting what the advertiser paid for is the C1, C2, C3 rating. That is the measurement of the viewership that was happening during the commercial. So I imagine picture in picture helps retain the viewership to that will actually happen during the commercial breaks. So I imagine it has, there's some sort of strategy or calculation that helps them. So I would believe that if they're doing it, they've been doing it for quite a long time, that they found that that's an effective strategy. I was curious that happens during AEW shows and NXT, but I don't think that happens during Raw or SmackDown, for what it's worth. I mean, if you think Raw, I mean, NBC Universal is doing it during NXT for on the USA Network. Why are they not doing it during Raw? I could be wrong. Not an avid Raw viewer, but I think that's what's happening.
All right. We'll move on here. And we actually, Fightful reported this on Monday. The Performance Center talent was informed this past weekend that they're no longer required the twice weekly COVID testing that has previously been mandatory. We've also learned the WWE main roster also got an email being informed that weekly testing isn't required. We were not told if there was a vaccination qualifier added to that ruling. And the Observer on Friday, we're told AEW was still testing people weekly who were not fully vaccinated, but those fully vaccinated were not being tested, or at least not regularly. Other sources in the company only said that there is also more to that policy than that without going into specifics.
Yes. So during a time when, we look at the COVID rates, which I think I've got slides on here for, this was as of yesterday. The daily confirmed cases of COVID in the United States are like twice as high as they've ever been right now. You're just telling me about someone who you know who has COVID before we started recording. Death rates are still lower than the worst of the worst here, because whatever, maybe it's Omicron, it's not as deadly. Maybe it's people are vaccinated, maybe both. Now the NFL is doing something similar. They're not testing people who are vaccinated. So I imagine WWE, and as we just learned just before the premium live event last night, Roman Reigns has COVID. NFL is not doing this. You can imagine Vince said, well, God damn it, the NFL isn't doing it. Why are we doing it? Now I think, what about AEW? Everybody, there was a lot of outrage on Twitter when this story came out. And I think it's a great example of, and maybe this story with Tony Khan tweeting about Big Swole is something like that too. That's a component of what's happening here, is that issues like this, especially on Twitter, but not limited to Twitter, are the judgment that you bring or don't bring to decisions like this or actions like this. I think you have a lot of it has to do with, is determined by, how much does this person or entity have the benefit of the doubt still. And WWE, with a lot of people, does not have the benefit of the doubt. And I noticed that no one was really asking or wondering about what's with AEW. But I mean, reporters were. And I was talking to some who were trying to find out. And I asked two people at AEW. Neither of them responded to me about what the latest was with their COVID testing. But the Observer did report this in the latest, Meltzer reported this in the latest edition of the Observer.
All right. And then
you want to read the Observer thing?
Oh, I did.
You did?
I read both. Yeah.
Oh, I've not been paying attention. Okay.
That's okay.
Yeah. So,
I read both. So,
yeah, I don't know. Let's talk about the Canadian cancellation. The Toronto cancellation, and we'll go back and talk about MSG.
Yeah, so this was from the Coca-Cola Coliseum. The WWE live event scheduled for December 29, 2021 at Coca-Cola Coliseum in Toronto has been rescheduled to Sunday, March 27, 2022. And then we have, let's see here. And then there isn't a tweet about this, but I'm pretty sure they canceled the event that was supposed to be in Quebec the same night as the WWE show.
Yeah. Where, so, you've got other countries, even in Canada, where their vaccination rate is higher. In Japan, where COVID cases are far lower per capita, they take this much, much more seriously, or the restrictions are far stronger in those countries than here. I've been on the PWI podcast a few days ago, and And they were asking me, you know, what I think is going to happen. I don't think the United States is going to roll back. I mean, how many people were masked in Buffalo in that arena? What would you say the percentage was?
Oh, it's zero because it's total vaccination.
Oh, you had to prove vaccination at least. Okay.
Right. Yes. You had to prove vaccination. But I did a independent wrestling show yesterday.
Yes.
And believe it or not, in a county that is traditionally red, 99% of the fans wear masks the whole time.
Okay. I don't think the United States is going to roll back ever from this. I think, you know, people in the United States have decided that this is enough. And, you know, I mean, it's there's a lot of, you know, you drive a car and we've decided that driving a car is worth the deaths that come with it. And flying planes is worth the deaths that come with it. People in the United States are not going to roll back. Maybe they should, but I don't think we're going to see live events roll back. Is that a factor in these attendances that we're seeing? Would the Buffalo attendance be higher? Would the MSG attendance be higher? You know, there's snow on the ground, and I know on Thursday, you know, Impact was on TV. Well, actually, nobody watches Impact, but you know, there was it's cold out right now. People want to stay home, and you know, people text now, and there's gaming, and there's TikTok is a big thing now. You know that TikTok is out there, and you know all of that. WWE is competing with. They're a media company, okay? They're not just wrestling. They're doing all of it. Marvel, the Spider-Man movie just came out. Really, really popular. So
the Matrix movie.
The Matrix movie. Yeah. I mean, there's Netflix. So MSG. I know Meltzer's saying that it's the lowest draw since not the 1930s. We do have some Polestar data. And this is the lowest that we've got on in the polls. The Polestar data is not a complete record of every WWE event, but it's a fair sample. Something like a third to a half of the WWE events in the last, you know, 20 years are in there. We don't have an attendance that's as slow, for MSG. WrestleTix has a tweet here mentioning the last 2 years. I believe these are Polestar numbers. Polestar numbers are tickets sold, and I don't know how Polestar gets this information, but I am told that these numbers reflect the Ticketmaster ticket audits. So this it doesn't get much more real than that. So the WWE always does a holiday tour MSG show in 2019 and 2018 on December 26th, same day, day after Christmas, they did an MSG show. 2019, 10,795. Year before that, 13,032. This year, what did they do, Gull? How many tickets distributed did WrestleTix find?
6,838.
Wow. I hear the Knicks are drawing okay in the same venue, same vaccination requirement. I hear the Sabres are, despite... How are the Sabres doing this year so far?
Not a playoff team, but not as bad as we thought they would be. They're not the worst team in the league.
Okay, so not a winning team.
But their attendance has been absolutely terrible. It's lowest in the NHL.
Is it? How low yes. are we talking?
8,000 average was the last thing that came out a couple weeks ago.
Okay, 8,000. What did they draw for WWE in Buffalo? 3,000.
They drew 3,000, yeah.
Yeah, well, okay. So why is attendance this low for MSG?
I mean, I it could be the product. It could be the general interest in the product. It could also, like, I mean, COVID could be a factor. You know,
I think Knicks sold out MSG maybe recently, like days before this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably the current product to the general fan.
I think here's a real factor though. In the 117 days. Our friend Corey Gibson, who does great research for us all the time here. I should probably put him in the credits as a special thanks. Put this together, this listing of, I believe the Observer reported the same thing, probably also from Corey, not credited though. From September 10th, your phone's right in front of the camera though. From September 10th to January 5th, there will have been 9 events in the tri-state area. WWE and MSG for SmackDown in September, the New York Prudential Center, AEW Dynamite, AEW Dynamite at Arthur Ashe, Survivor Series at Barclays Center, Raw at Barclays Center, Raw at UBS Arena, Dynamite at UBS Arena. This is in Long Island. W House Show at MSG on December 26th. And then AEW is going to the Prudential Center again in Newark this Wednesday for Dynamite. So a lot of events. Is there anything comparable to that? Really just examples from the hottest period in the history of wrestling in 98, 99, and 2000, where, you know, WCW ran two events and WF ran six events. WCW in 98 or in 2000 ran one event and WF ran seven events. Those attendances were much stronger in that period. I won't go through the numbers, but you can see them on the screen if you're watching on YouTube. So there's all that.
All right. Yeah. Any final thoughts on this holiday tour stuff?
Not really.
Or just live events in general?
Not really for now. We do have, as I was scrambling to get ready, we're gonna have to look at the straight up Excel spreadsheet. YouTube numbers. Can you see this?
Yeah. I have it up here.
No, that's old. That's slides. Old. I didn't update it.
Oh, it's old?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So can't really see it, but no.
I'm gonna refresh this data. You're gonna see this live in the air. Look at all this data I've got here. It's in the Excel spreadsheet. The Python script hits YouTube every hour, every 60 minutes. Task scheduler opens up. It hits YouTube and it asks it not just about WD and AEW, but about some 20 YouTube channels. And let's see here. What have we got? The most watched YouTube video. New content only. Posted in the last 7 days. And we say, after 24 hours, what was your view count? Number one, Raw. Almost 1 million. 900,000 views for the top 10 moments of Raw. The top five slots are all WWE. Edge soaks Miz in the black blood. No, it's not blood. It's a brood bath. We can't say blood. That would be too violent. Number three, the top 10 moments of SmackDown. Number four, Miz and Maryse are distraught after the brood bath at their wedding. Number 10, the top 10 moments of SmackDown. I feel like I just said that. Number three is the most surprising moments of SmackDown. And this is from separate weeks. Apparently this is still within the last 7 days, both of these are.
Can I just ask a question here, like while we're going through this? Mm-hmm. Does this kind of show how WWE is being consumed in the aspect of people are probably just watching the top 10 moments instead of actually watching Raw and SmackDown?
Let's imagine a really favorable case for WWE where maybe they're watching the top 10 and then maybe they're picking and choosing the other moments that they also watch. I don't know. You know, who knows? By the way, these are global numbers too.
Cause I've done that. I've like not watched Raw and SmackDown and watched the top 10s.
You watch the top 10
recap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, when people have asked me about this before, I think YouTube, you have to do YouTube. If you're not doing YouTube, that would be foolish. It generates some money, not a lot. It's on the level of, for what WWE would be, a decent international deal. I think this is about $30 million per year for them. Their biggest international TV deal is India, $50 million. So this is probably on the level of what they're getting from the UK, though. But anyway, if you're seeing, though, a migration of views from linear to digital, which I don't know how you would track, but let's say lots of people who used to watch through actual TV are now watching or just picking it up through YouTube or whatever. I think, well, part of that is a change in behavior in the way that people consume media. The cable bundle subscriptions are declining. Yeah, people are using digital forms of media far more. But I think what's also a component to that is contributing to that change in behavior in WWE's case in particular is probably the urgency with which or the lack of urgency with which, it's purely speculation on my part, but the lack of urgency with which fans feel that they have to consume this content. If this is a big deal and it feels really consequential and important, I'm more likely to watch it live. If it sucks, I'll watch it later, maybe. And we see that especially in younger age groups, where what the episodes that are most often, the episodes that are really highly viewed also tend to be the episodes that are especially high in 18 to 34 viewership young adults. Look at that CM Punk episode where he debuted in Rampage. The median age was 43, among the lowest that I've ever seen. Anyway, number six finally is watch how Cody Rhodes became the first TNT champion. And we could go on from there. We have to scroll to number 64 before we see another company's YouTube video here, which is Noah with only 83,000 views. So Noah beating out New Japan. It's not till a few slots later at 70 that we see a New Japan video. These are the Noah videos that performed this well are both Kenta. They have Kenta in them. I can see that in the Romaji. Something that I want to start to look at, and we'll look at briefly here, and then before and we'll let you go, Gull. You can go to Social Blade, which is also how we looked at the Tony Khan tweet rate. And you can get the total count of WWE's YouTube views theoretically, notwithstanding any videos that they delete or set to private. Basically, I want to know how much of their views are new content that's actually been published in the last 7 days and how much of it is not. So it's from everything that's older than 7 days. They have a massive library on YouTube. And what I found was that for AEW, it looks like within the last 7 days, about 70% of AEW's YouTube views in the last 7 days are of content posted in the last 7 days. 70% for AEW. Makes sense, and AEW is obviously a newer company with only a couple years of history. For WWE, it's about 18% of their views in the last 7 days are of content posted in the last 7 days. So while you can say,
a lot of nostalgia.
Well, maybe, who knows? It could be just, I mean, probably not, but it could be from stuff posted 2 weeks ago rather than 1 week ago. But, you know, I think that's a really exemplary stat in that WWE is empowered by this massive legacy. It's decades of domination of the wrestling space. You see that manifest in YouTube views where people are looking at, I've had people ask me, how much of those YouTube views are actually of new content? How much of it is people just going back and looking at old stuff? Well, maybe 70% maybe is old stuff. And it's a way in which their massive legacy, their massive video library, can obscure their apparent success. And it's still valuable. I mean, old content on YouTube is probably generating the same kind of ad revenue that new content is. Yes, it's all compromised by being largely outside the US, and which so the impressions aren't as valuable and it lowers the CPM. But I want to look at least partly separated. We can look at two different views at least about how many views is your new content attracting? How popular is this? I'm pointing at my TV that's right above the monitor. How popular is this content? Not just people going back and watching stuff from all different years and eras. And that tells us if we see trends in that, then that informs what we might expect when we look at television ratings, attendance, merchandise sales, and things of that nature. That's it.
All right. One thing we did want to discuss, and you already alluded to it earlier in the show, but WWE now calling its pay-per-views premium live events.
Yes. The press releases have been retconned. They are not pay-per-views anymore, which makes sense. They're not primarily consumed through pay-per-view. Premium live events. I would like to have listened in on the meetings where they ruminated over what they were going to call them.
You think Michael Hayes said, what about a supercard?
It's too wrestling.
too wrestling.
But like the press release on the corporate website has been changed. Not just the headline, but all these little bullet points. You know, Sunday, May 8th, premium event, premium live event. It's not a big deal, but it's just emblematic, symptomatic of WWE's constant use of words that no one uses. And just sort of the lack of transparency. They could just be like, hey, look, Michael Cole could be like, hey, look, we know we haven't been primarily, you haven't been primarily watching this through pay-per-view, and you know, since 2014. We've decided that we're going to call them premium live events now. But there's, it's just like, poof, nope, premium live events, premium live event, as if pay-per-view? No, we never called them pay-per-views. It was always this way, this sort of 1984 lack of respect for the viewer. In isolation, if this was the only time that they ever did something like this, yes, it would be complaining about things for no reason. But it's a symptom of a larger disease.
All right.
Okay. That's all for now. I'll be talking to David Bixenspan in a moment. If you're listening on audio, if you're watching live, that'll be on your podcast app later tonight. Please hit the like, hit the thumbs up if you like this. It helps people discover it and discover WrestleNomics. Subscribe if you haven't already. Share it. Give us a nice review on your podcast app if you're listening that way. The live TV ratings talk happens on this YouTube channel, the WrestleNomics YouTube channel, every Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, where we go deep into depth. And that's mainly where all the live, where all the TV ratings discussion happens. You can also go to the Post Wrestling Discord and go into the WrestleNomics channel and discuss wrestling business there. Thanks, as always, to the Post Wrestling family for distributing WrestleNomics. The holiday season is over, and Post Wrestling, John and Way are finally back. And what plugs have you got?
Yeah, first that we just released last week, our deep dive into the Ring of Honor CCW War of late 2005 to the summer of 2006. And I just want to personally, because I know a lot of WrestleNomics listeners have migrated over to listening to Rediscovering Indies, and myself and Jonathan Ash, we want to thank you guys. We hit our all-time listener record in the month of December.
Wow.
So really want to thank everybody for listening. And the Ring of Honor CCW episode's very, very good perspective. And it's crazy to see the majority of the names that are involved now in AEW and WWE and whatnot. So, and you know, here's the thing. The question I pondered, it may be the greatest interpromotional feud of all time, because it didn't hurt either company,
which is rare. Yes. Unfortunately, we will not be having the meeting of Golo and Bix here to discuss who did the better John Collins review. But yeah,
they had Bo James, so they got me on that one.
Okay, you can subscribe to WrestleNomics on Patreon and get access to my almost everyday TV ratings reports. Patreon.com/WrestleNomics for just $5 a month. It's early in the month. We're recording this on January 2nd. It's the best time to sign up, so you get that full month worth of value. You also get access on Patreon to the WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet with over 20,000 data points for TV ratings going back to late 2014. You follow us on Twitter at Brandon Thurston, at Chris Gull, at WrestleNomics, at RTI Pod. And that's it. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.